You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Julie Locker. Julie, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thanks, Eric. It's good to be here.
So, Julie, the way the show begins is, well, the show is about getting to know each other in a region where we have a lot of people and we don't really know each other.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me, who are you? You know, what's a sketch or qualities that make up who you are?
Well, obviously, I guess the stuff that I do is, like, I just graduated from Cornell and I'm an actor, and I know that's not who I am, but I still feel like I have to say it somehow, and it doesn't feel right not to.
Right.
But, like, I'm 21 years old. I'm a big dreamer. I'm really excited for my future. You know, I want to be an actor, and I'm chasing my dreams and doing that whole thing. And I try to be a deep thinker. I like to wander around and think about, like, the depth of the question of who I am and, like, what, yes, like, what it really means to be who I am, you know? And, you know, I consider myself to be, like, a fun, energetic person. And, yeah, that's a brief summary.
Right. And you just graduated, so you're in the middle of all sorts of transitions.
Yeah.
Where are you headed now?
So right now, since I still have a couple more weeks in Ithaca, doing a couple shows, I'm moving out of my apartment this weekend, and so I'm moving into someone else's house and staying with them for a couple weeks.
Then it's I'm a going typical home Ithaca for a story.
Month. Yeah. Then I'm going home for a month, and then I'm off to England to study to get my MFA in acting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And we're gonna pick up on these storylines in a minute, including the shows that you're involved with.
Mm-hmm.
But first, let's go to your music. You brought some music with you. What do you want to start with? And what do you want to say about it?
Let's start with this song, "Big Machine" by the Goo Goo Dolls. It's my absolute favorite song in the whole world. I love this song because I think it's very bittersweet. It's not like a purely happy or a purely sad song. It's sort of about finding something positive and something that's really hard to deal with. And it also has a nice full rock sound that I just love.
Cool. Here we go.
Turn your anger into lust. I'm still here, but you don't trust it all.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Julie Locker. So, Julie, what brought you to Cornell? And how was your experience here?
Well, I decided to come to Cornell because I was originally planning to study biology and theater. I wanted to be a double major, and I thought I was possibly pre-law. So I was sort of looking for a school that was good at a bunch of different things and could sort of help me figure out where I wanted to go and then help me get there. And I definitely got seduced, I guess, by like the rankings and the prestige a little bit. Yep. So I was looking for that. And I came to Cornell, and my experience was definitely not what I expected it to be. I think I walked in with sort of a closed mind, as like, this is what I want to do. I already know that, and I didn't take the time to explore some other subjects. So I was spending a lot of time doing biology and theater, and then I sort of discovered that biology was not what I was interested in, and I wanted to do it because I had sort of heard this thing that, like, in order to, like, get a good job and have a good life, you should do math and science. And, you know, biology was the science that I liked best, but I was doing it, and I was like, oh, my God, I can't do this for the rest of my life. I can't get a job with this. So I switched to math for a little while, and I sort of had the same thing. I was just, like, you know, I liked it enough to do it for, like, a couple semesters, and then I was like, no, I can't do this anymore. And then I really just had to examine sort of the culture that I was in and what I had grown up to believe about what success means.
Right. What incident helped you to kind of bring that to focus?
Or
was there one incident or kind of a time period that...
Yeah, there was an incident that had occurred, like, long before I actually made the decision to just switch to performing media arts. I was in a section for a biology class. I was taking this cell bio class, and I used to have a big flair for hyperbolizing, especially about my grades. And so I would be like, oh my gosh, this test is going to be so hard. I'm going to fail. I'm going to die. I'm going to drop out of college. Everything's going to be terrible. So I was in this section, like, doing this. And I think the order that I said it, I was like, I'm going to fail the test. I'm going to drop out of college, and then I'm going to die. And my TA was like, you know, you don't have to go to college to live a good life. She was like, you can still have a good life without a college degree. And this was literally news to me. That was literally a revelation to me.
And so you were catastrophizing, and she was taking you seriously.
Yeah.
And the answer got in.
Right. And that moment just stuck with me. And, you know, a couple years later, when I was, like, confronting my major, I was like, you know, that's true. It's like, not only could I have a good life if I didn't go to college, I could have a good life if I graduated without a math or science degree. I can have a good life without, like, being a doctor or a scientific researcher. Like, my life is what I make of it. And so I decided just to go for what I want to do, which is theater.
And what makes that good? I mean, you said you could have a good life.
Yeah. I think for me, that means being happy in that, you know, like, again, pursuing what I want to do makes me happy, and just living, like, having fulfilling relationships and having time to do that. And, like, you know, it's not money. It's more than money, and more than somebody, like, living up to somebody else's idea of success.
Right. So is this the first big kind of change in understanding of who you are that you've worked through?
I think it is, yeah.
Because there's life. I mean, that's good in itself. There's a feeling of like, being able to claim your own life.
Yeah.
Which is good in and of itself. And
right.
It may change over time, too.
Yeah. It's true. I guess that's not the first one, but it, I think, has had some of the most, like, the biggest repercussions, like, on my life that I'm feeling right now. Yeah.
Sure. So how did your attitude towards education and your experience of life change once you committed to what's the department called now? I forgot.
Performing and Media Arts.
Performing
yeah.
and Media Arts. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. My attitude towards education.
And yourself.
Yeah. I became a little disenchanted with like the modern education system that we have now.
It's a little cynical.
Yeah. I read this book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite. And I read it and I was like, oh my gosh, this is my life, you know, where it's like, you know, we have all of these college students at these elite schools who are sort of aimless and are doing things because somebody told them that it's what they should be doing and not sort of driven internally mm-hmm. and just kind of jumping through hoop after hoop after hoop and not knowing why we're doing it, you know. Right. That was my life. And so I've become disenchanted with the way the American, like the elite education system has sort of set that up for us, especially as they're trying to increase their rankings and, you know, get more funding and spending time doing that instead of trying to develop the minds that they have at their disposal. And, you know, the way we're turning to value, we're not valuing humanities as much as we used to in art and how a lot of it is about like science and trade and computer science and business and, you know, stuff like that, which I think is really unfortunate and is causing a lot of people to be very unhappy.
I just want to parse this out a little bit. What I'm hearing is that what's unfortunate isn't that actual area of study, but when it's engaged as, when you are being prepared rather than building upon experiences that you choose.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're being prepared, somebody else is leading you. It's like the animal led on the halter,
right?
You know, as opposed to deciding where you're going to go. And life really needs to be a balance of both, because we need to be able to move with others at their lead. And we also need to be able to just pull everybody along with us or ourselves, at least when the time comes.
Yeah, true.
So you were a little cynical. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially if you feel like you've been kind of sold out along the way.
Yeah.
So then what kinds of, how did your course selection change? How did your engagement of your education change?
Well, obviously I stopped taking math and science.
Right.
And I was just taking acting classes. I started for the first time to take classes just for fun that like weren't for the requirements or anything. I was just like, I want to take this directing class because it'll be really good for me. And like, I want to take this science fiction class. And so that was really interesting. I stopped worrying about my grades so much and just trying to do my best, but also making time to like have a full life, I think, and to be able to, you know, spend time with my friends and to, you know, give myself some space if I needed to. And, you know, not worry if I got a B+ instead of an A-, you know, the way I might have worried about that before. Which fortunately is a luxury in like the acting career that like my GPA really isn't that important, for my future. Yeah.
Unless you go to graduate school in something else at some point.
Right. In something
and,
else.
And by that point you will be an older person
right.
with other things
exactly.
at play. So why graduate school in acting? And why England? Why London?
I decided that at Cornell, I spent my Cornell experience, you know, finding myself in the way that I just described to you.
Yeah.
As opposed to getting really serious training in my craft that would prepare me for a professional career. So I'm leaving Cornell feeling like really comfortable in who I am and where I want to go and what I want to do, which is awesome, but not feeling like I have the training to be a professional actor.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to do a really intensive 2-year program to just get that training so that I can, you know, get jobs.
Sure. You want to make it work.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I decided to go to London. This is a super cool program. It's an international program. So everybody in my class is going to be from outside the UK. Lots of American students, too. I think that England has some of the best drama training in the world. And they have a different style of doing it where, you know, places like Juilliard and Yale and NYU, the best places in the U.S., have their method of training, and they want you to learn their method, and they don't necessarily build on the skills you already have. They'll right. break you down and give you their set of skills. Whereas, like, the England training, it's a shorter program, which is nice, and they don't do that. They'll build on what I have, so.
And what does that mean, to build on what you have? Because I understand in it's a very traditional crafts program. They kind of strip you of all your what you perceived skill, and they say you start from zero and you right. build up. And that's a very authoritarian model of, right. of teaching. What's different in what do you expect to be different in
England? I would just expect that, you know, instead of saying like, here is the foundation that you need to start from, it'll be like, here's a scene, like, let's work on it right. in class, so you start, and then figure out what you need.
So you bring your stuff to the scene, they see what you have, they work with you, and then you learn. And
that would be the hope.
Right. And so you also learn to see how other people react
yeah.
and where they are, so right. you can talk to them.
Yeah.
Cool. Let's cut to music quickly, and then okay. we'll come back and talk about the two shows you're involved with this yeah. summer. So what should we play next?
Let's play Ain't Been Done by Jessie J.
Okie doke. I'ma do it like I ain't been done. 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 Can't beat me. I'm a show shot winner. One of a kind. I'm original. I'm so ill. Gonna need a painkiller. Stealing the show like. Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Julie Locker. So, Julie, you're involved in two productions this summer. One is with the Tin Can Theater, which was historically with the Ithaca Youth Bureau, was sponsored by Ithaca Youth Bureau, and is now being managed by Civic Ensemble, and also with another Civic Ensemble production. Do you want to tell me a bit about these shows? And
yeah, sure. Up?
Sure.
So the Tin Can show this year is called Power to Help, Power to Hurt. It's a play that we have four actors. And we worked with our directors and, of course, you, Eric, with Shared Journeys to develop the script of the play, which is about religious bullying in schools. So it's about four kids all with different religious backgrounds and different feelings about how they want to share their religions or not share them in the world and how they want to apply them to their play that they're writing in theater camp. And so they have to sort of navigate all of those differences. And then the second show, I'm just on crew for mm-hmm. My Children, My Africa, mm-hmm. Which is about a school, like a classroom in South Africa during apartheid. And this, it's just three characters, yeah. Two students and a teacher. And the teacher's trying to convince the students that to use education instead of violence to solve their problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and that's set in South Africa in 1984 when a lot of things were in transition,
mm-hmm.
And yeah. So let's go back to let's talk about these for a couple of seconds. One is in the Power to Help, Power to Hurt. The four characters, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, and non-religious, they each end up engaging in some bullying or pushy behavior.
Yes.
And they each are bullied and they each are bystanders and they all in some sense have to come to terms with who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as Julie mentioned, I was part of the creative team behind it, though I'm not part of the show. How has that been received? This is a show that's performed for children at summer camps,
mm-hmm.
and you are setting the show in a summer camp where you have to come up with a play.
Yes.
And whether you include your religion or your values, if they're secular, in it or not, or whether you look at your life work becomes the major issue. How have children received it? How have staff received it?
I'm definitely seeing the kids hear the message and really see how difficult it can be to navigate these questions. What we have them do at the end, the kids have to decide whether they want to include religion in their play or not. And so they're unable to decide themselves. So we have the audience help them and they vote with their feet. And it's really amazing because we have the keep religion in the play section. We have the don't keep religion in the play section. And then there's an I don't know option. And for almost all the shows we've gone to, almost everyone has gone to the I don't know first.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ask them, we're like, okay, the play's tomorrow. We really have to make a decision. And they have to choose a side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always very split. And, you know, then we ask people, was this a hard decision? Was this an easy decision? And we're hearing people say, it was a really hard decision because I don't want to force this character to do something that they don't want. But I also don't want to force this character to do something that they don't want.
Right.
And so they sort of understand the real difficulty of, you know, these people having these conflicting things that they want. And
they experience the dilemma.
Right, yeah. And so it's really cool to see that they hear that message. And they offer really good ideas for, like, you know, there's a scene where there's a big fight and two of the characters are really bullying each other and insulting each other. And then we ask the kids for ideas for what they could have done differently. And we're hearing such great, like, accepting, open ideas of, like, mm-hmm. how, you know, we can accept each other better. So that's
and
really
how they
cool.
could stop it from escalating.
Yes.
One of the neat things about civic ensemble and this kind of civic theater is that it's the show stops and the audience gets to step in,
right.
and shape where it goes. And
yeah.
that's just, and for kids, that's like giving them a tremendous power.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is interesting the way the staff has received it, because often, you know, the camp director has come up to us a couple times at the end of the show and been like, you know, this topic might be too much for kids this young, or, you know, something mm-hmm. like that. Or one lady asked us if any parents had called in to complain about some of the mm-hmm. stuff that we were teaching their kids. And we were like, no, we haven't heard anything. But, you know, it's like, obviously they're more, I think they're more uncomfortable to deal. The adults are more uncomfortable to really confront the problems.
Right.
Yeah.
And the kids just want to try to figure out how to live with it.
Yep.
Yeah. When my daughter was three, she was trying to sort out myself as an ordained minister
mm-hmm.
with her mother, who's an atheist, and how we were together and trying to figure out what that was about.
Yeah.
And we had many conversations, and at three, she could navigate it. Yeah. It's just, but at her language and at her concepts. So, yeah, cool. Cool. So if you're still going to be in performance through the 9th of August, and people Correct. Who might want to observe this or bring you on could still schedule a performance at the last minute.
Yes.
And they need to be in touch with Nancy Kane, NKANE, at cityofithaca.org if they would like to book a performance. And we're hoping to get a video of this so that we can have a record of it.
Yeah.
Good. And you also mentioned My Children, My Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That's set after the death of Stephen Biko and before the real last push of the elimination of apartheid in that time where it could have gotten even much more violent or mm-hmm. it could have been more peaceful. So the play deals with that transition.
Yes.
And it's going to be performed at the Lehman Alternative Community School in the Black Box Theater, August 4th through 7th and 11th through 14th. That's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Thursday and Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and Sunday at 4 p.m. And if you want more information about that, go to civicensemble.org. What about theater? You're on the crew.
Mm-hmm.
With the second one, what about yes. being crew? Do you like what's or how? I mean, it's work; it's summer work, but mm-hmm. but also in your life in theater, what are the different roles that you have enjoyed besides acting?
I've done several different roles. I at Cornell have stage managed. I've been on running crew. I've worked in the costume shop and the set shop to build the set and the mm-hmm. costumes. And I think it's nice to contribute to a play in a way that is more than just being on stage. Like, sometimes it's nice to be able to contribute to something without people necessarily even being aware that you're doing the work.
Right, right.
And I like that. And just knowing that it's just so necessary. Like, actors would be nothing without crew people.
And lights and sound
right,
and
exactly.
all the other things that go, yeah.
Right,
yeah,
so it just feels good to help in that way.
Right. What is the role of theater in your life? How do you see, or what do you see as, why is theater important? Why does it matter?
Theater is important because, you know, I think it's important in doing the work that, like Civic Ensemble does. I think it's a way to engage with social problems and to bring certain issues to light. But it also, even in more subtle ways, I think helps make people more empathetic. Like, certainly mm-hmm. actors, like, obviously I have had to become a more empathetic person in order to play certain characters and to sort of try to understand like what they might be going through. And I like to think that happens with the audience as well, that, you know, especially there's something different about seeing something live and seeing a real person right in front of you. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. not the same distance as you have when you're watching something on a TV screen that was shot through a camera. It's not as mediated. It's just so much more tangible and real and brings you so much closer to what people are really going through.
And yet it's not you living the experience.
Right.
And so it's the one, the slight step distance for reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Neat. When I lost my train of thought, but that happens to me sometimes. With this change in career
mm-hmm.
And change in sense of vocation and direction and purpose, how have your parents reacted?
My mom, fortunately, has been so supportive. It caught me by surprise a lot because, you know, when I was younger, she also really encouraged me to be a doctor. And I think for, to a certain degree, she herself, she teaches physics and astronomy at a community college.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes she regrets not going into medicine, mm-hmm. Especially because she, I guess, mostly decided not to because that's what her older sister was doing. And, you know, she didn't want to just follow in her footsteps, which I totally understand. I have an older sister as well. But so she encouraged me to do that. And she also, obviously, she's into physics and astronomy. She loves science and she thinks it's really important. And she wanted me to go into that. And then, you know, when I got to college, she really seemed to understand and empathize with the fact that I was just really deeply unhappy with what I was doing. And that mattered to her so much. And she just gave, you know, she said the most supportive thing, which was, she was like, I know that you are going to figure out how to support yourself. She's like, you are the kind of person, you're going to figure out what you need to do and you're going to do it. And I'm not worried about you at all.
So if you had perceived a kind of a rope that was preparing you or pulling you through like a sheep, she cut it.
Yeah. Yeah. And she's just letting me make my choices, mm-hmm. which is really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And probably not completely, not, I mean, choices, but from a distance of watching mm-hmm. and being able to be there would be my guess, just yeah. from what you've described.
Definitely. Yeah. And she's definitely still, she's here to give me advice, and I often call her, like, what do I do? And she, like, she really helps me, so.
Yeah, that's neat. That's
yeah.
When, and it's played differently with your father.
Yeah, well, I haven't spoken to him in years,
okay,
so.
Okay, sorry, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
So, when you're in this transition, I'm really grateful that you made time this weekend when you were having to move out of your apartment and move to a temporary place yeah. and then move to another yeah. temporary place and then move to England. I want to go back a little bit to, The character you play in Power to Help, Power to Hurt is that of a non-religious youth mm-hmm. who's very into science, but these kids are 10, 11 years old in terms of their aging. How did that feel comfortable with where you were from, and how did you have to learn different things to play that role?
It was comfortable because in some ways the character that I'm playing is who I was when mm-hmm. I was about 12. I was not, you know, I considered myself an atheist, and I still do. And I was not very open-minded at all, and I sort of had this idea that religion was delusional and mm-hmm. that science mm-hmm. was the only thing that mattered, and you know, I thought people were brainwashed who believed in religion and believed in God. And, you know, unfortunately, I was a bully. Like, I told people what I thought about that, like, fairly freely. And they in response, told me what they thought of me very freely. So
you fought with those words.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's more than just telling. It's like, it's right. condemning. You condemn yes. them and they condemned you in return.
Yeah, I definitely did that. And so I brought, as we were writing the play, like, some of the words that my character says were just words that I had said mm-hmm. or, you know, words that other people had said to me.
Right.
And I just brought that very directly. But I did have to change and adjust and not just make it my own life, because, you know, talking to the other actors, it sort of seemed like my experience was fairly atypical in honestly how mean people were to each other at my middle school, because the other actors sort of thought that some of the ideas that I had for, like, what people would say was, like, too much. Like, nobody says that was something that I heard a couple times.
No, I know. Yes. And you heard it. And I know, yeah. and I know from your physical reaction that you had heard it.
Right. Yeah. So, I think we brought it back, you know. It wasn't, mm-hmm. especially the kids that we're playing are a little younger. It's not quite middle school, but
they're just about to go to middle school, right. which is why the timing is important.
Right. Yeah. So,
Cool. Well, that reality, the counterweight of that reality was really important in the making the play mm-hmm. credible. Also what you've just said about becoming, you know, you are still the person you were, but less demanding of others about that and more open. And what's really exciting to me, watching this culture go from a place where religion is something of domination, or religion is to be dominated, which has been the last fight for the last 200 years, particularly among elites. We don't have to see that in the next generation. Not in that way. Not in that way. So thank you for participating and help make the show bring that message out.
Yeah, and thank you for your help on that.
Let's cut to music. Let's cut to your third song. What shall we play? The Harry Chapin song?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. And this is "I Want to Learn a Love Song." Do you want to say something about it, or just let it speak for itself?
Just let it speak for itself.
Okay. Dope.
I never did it to Nancy, so I'll do it for her. Okay. A one, a two, a one, two, three, four. I come fresh from the street, fast on my feet, kind of crass and corny. Not much meat on my bones, and a whole lot alone, and more than a little bit horny. The old six string was all I had to keep my belly still. And for each full hour less than I gave, I got a crisp $10 bill. You see, she was married for 7 years to a concrete castle king. She said she wanted to learn to play the guitar and to hear her children sing. So I'd show up about once a week in my faded tight leg jeans, with a backlog full of hobo stories and a laugh a day to dream. She said, I want to learn a love song full of happy things. She said, I want to learn a love song, won't you let me hear you sing? She said, I want to learn a love song, I want to hear you play. She said, I want to learn a love song before you go away. So I tried to teach her a couple of chords and an easy melody, but it always turned out she'd rather listen to my guitar and me. I could hear her old man laughing in the den, playing stud poker with the boys, while I sang so soft in the living room, too scared to make much noise. I came 1 week, the den was dark, and she met me at the door. And we sat on the couch and we sang and talked till I could not sing no more. You know the silence kept on building, her eyes grew much too wide, and I could hear both of our heartbeats, but there was no place to hide.
She said, I want to learn a love song, won't you let me
guess you know I stay.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Julie Locker. So, Julie, you grew up in Springfield and Dayton, Ohio. Mm-hmm. So, what's it like to grow up in Central Ohio?
It's definitely different from being in Ithaca. I grew up in this big yellow house outside of Springfield, Ohio, in the country. So I had a cornfield on one side, a pasture on the other, a giant woods behind us. Three doors down, people raised bison. So, you know, I spent my childhood playing outside a lot. Mm-hmm. My best friends lived down the street from me, so we would go, I would like bike down to their house, and we would play in the creek and catch crawdads and do that whole thing. And yeah, it was a good time.
Mm-hmm. And you come from a bicultural background.
Yes.
How did that shape your, especially growing up in the middle of the, in the middle of Ohio? Yeah.
Yeah, it was very important in shaping who I was. So my mom's from India, and I was raised Hindu, and my dad's from Ohio. So basically, at first, I went to a private school with a lot of other people of color. There were lots of Muslims, lots of Hindus, and some wealthier white people. And then I ended up moving in fourth grade to a public school, which was, we had some 600 kids, and I think that there were maybe two other people of color there. So that was challenging for me because, you know, I would tell people that I was half Indian and they would say, oh, what tribe? And we'd be, no, my mom's from India.
South Asian India, not American Indian.
Right. And especially because, you know, I don't look South Asian as a biracial person. But and then even then, when I would say my mom's from India, there were a lot of people who didn't know where India was or what it was. I remember one day my fourth grade teacher got so frustrated with people not knowing what that meant that she literally she derailed class, pulled down this world map and said, this is India. This is where Julie's mom is from.
And did that make you feel more included, or did that emphasize the exclusion, the how outside you were for people?
Yeah, I definitely think it emphasized, you know, how outside I felt.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because, you know, being biracial, and especially I don't speak the Indian language, Tamil, that my family speaks. I, in the Indian community, also feel like an outsider.
Right.
So, you know, I sort of have never felt like I really belonged anywhere. And I tend to be like very aware of my race all the time. And yeah, also my religion, like in fourth grade, you know, I wasn't an atheist yet. I was still a Hindu. And that's kind of when the religious bullying started, with people like, oh, you believe there are multiple gods? No, there's only one God. That's stupid. Like,
right.
Like, you're going to go to hell. Like, stuff like that. Which was a new experience, and it was really difficult.
And you didn't have the tools to tell them that their one God is multiple, almost unrecognizable versions, depending upon. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough. So, when you look back on those, and in growing up there, and that transition, what do you take away from it that you value? And what do you take away from it that you wish hadn't happened?
I'm glad that I sort of understand that that is something that exists in the world and that needs to be changed. You know, I know a lot of people at Cornell who, you know, grew up in like fairly diverse, like upper middle class areas, and didn't have those same sorts of experiences at all, and are sort of blown away by the fact that, you know, like, you should write about that, like, you were bullied religiously, like, blah blah blah. And I'm sort of like, I think it's fairly common probably. And so I'm glad that I understand that, and I'm glad that I now am able to look back on the things that I said to people and the things that other people said to me, and to say that, you know, the way I didn't accept them was wrong, mm-hmm. and the way they didn't accept me was wrong, but the reason I did it was because I was so hurt mm-hmm. all the time, you right. know, and that is probably true for a lot of them as well. And I think it helped me create the understanding that I sort of have about the way people treat each other, that I've found in my personal experience that most of the time when people are deliberately mean to each other, it's stems from their own hurt somewhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my teachers would like tell me that and I didn't believe them, but now I've like really seen it, that that's what I do.
Right.
So.
And I needed to learn that it's both hurt and a poor use of power.
Yeah.
Because we all have some power.
Right.
And sometimes when we've been hurt, we use it in the worst possible way.
Right.
To inflict hurt on others. And it's understandable. And we kind of have to live through to the point where we realize that. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what bullying is about. And I think why people do it a lot in mm-hmm. middle school is because they are beginning to say, I have some power to define me.
Right.
And I'm not going to let you, and I'm going to use that on you. And I'm not going to let you define me. And it goes back and forth with parents and kids and peers and the whole bit. But it's all about not being very skillful.
Right.
With power.
Yeah, and that's why our show is called Power to Help, Power to Hurt. So you have
the power
to do both things.
And Sarah and I, when we realized that bullying was a misuse of power, we very quickly landed on that title just mm-hmm. over a table conversation, just trying to figure out how are we going to pull this together.
Yeah.
And that's it surprised me how quickly that became clear. So tell me now, one of the things that I like to end the show on, and we've got about 10 minutes before our last song, is what do you do to take care of yourself? What do you do on a daily basis, weekly, monthly, yearly basis? What do you do to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and intellectually?
I love to exercise. That's uh-huh. definitely the biggest one for me. I run. I've recently gotten into spinning, and I lift weights.
Mm-hmm.
So
like dervish spinning, or what's what do you, oh, you mean?
Like on the, like on an exercise
bike.
Oh,
yeah.
So, you know, you can like go to a spinning class and it's,
right.
I mean, it's very similar to like run, like I ran cross country in middle school. It's like so similar to that, where it's like you can increase resistance to like simulate a hill, or like
right.
you'll pedal really fast when you're right. racing. So
and you're using similar. A term that my ignorance, it got my ignorance.
No worries.
Yeah.
Yeah, so definitely that. And I consider myself an ambivert, but I definitely have introvert tendencies. Mm-hmm. So like I know when I'm like, okay, I need to take a break from people and go read a book mm-hmm. or like watch TV or listen to a podcast like on my own. Mm-hmm.
How do you know you need to do that?
Usually I'll just reach a point where if there's just a lot going on and I'm stressed out, I'll reach this point of irritability where I'm just like, okay, I just haven't taken enough time for myself right now.
You're upset with yourself at that point.
Yeah. It's like I just get irritated by like the smallest things, and then I'm sitting there like, why am I so irritated? Like, why am I so, and it's like because I just haven't given myself.
When did you make space. That observation?
I don't know. Sometime I think in high school, by 11th or 12th grade, when my academics really started picking up in rigor, and mm-hmm. I imposed no homework Fridays. So, you know, I could work myself to death every other day of the week, but on Friday, I was going home, I was not doing homework,
yep.
I was going to sit and watch TV or read or practice my guitar or whatever it was that I was going to do, and, you know, just not work mm-hmm. and often like sometimes I would spend time with people on those evenings and sometimes I wouldn't, so mm-hmm. yeah, and that was a rule that I carried into college with me, no homework Fridays, and I really think it helped.
Yeah, I had to learn in college how to put limits because I worked way too much my first 2 years
mm-hmm.
and did very poorly the second of those 2 years.
Yeah,
and then I put limits on it and then things began to improve.
Yeah,
the less I worked the less hard I worked and the more focused I worked,
yeah,
the better.
Yeah, I'm also good at timing how long I'm spending on work and giving myself timed breaks. Mm-hmm. So like every 50 minutes, I'll take a 10-minute break.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is helpful.
Yeah, and all of that you began to lay down in high school. You began to kind of work. Cool. Those are many of the important life skills. So what do you do intellectually and emotionally?
Emotionally, I meditate. I'm trying to get into mindfulness meditation and learning to create distance between myself and my emotions so that if I get overwhelmed or, you know, depressed or whatever, I can distance myself from it and not judge it and feel it, but not live inside it.
It doesn't consume you.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's something I've been working on. Intellectually, I don't know. I like reading books and listening to podcasts that sort of teach me about things. I'm really interested in this podcast called Dear Hank and John. I don't know if you know.
No, I don't know it.
Okay, so Hank and John Green have this YouTube channel called The Vlog Brothers. And John Green, if you don't know, is the New York Times bestselling author of, like, The Fault in Our Stars, Looking for Alaska, Paper Towns, etc. And he and his brother Hank started this YouTube channel where they would talk to each other every day, like, through the YouTube, but only through the YouTube channel. And then it turned into something that people watched. And so sometimes, like, they're just really silly and humorous, or sometimes it'll be, like, Benghazi explained, or, like, the crisis in Greece explained. Uh-huh. And so they'll do that. And then they eventually created more educational channels, like SciShow and Crash Course, they're called. Mm-hmm. So they do, like, Crash Course history, psychology, all sorts of things. And now they've created a podcast where they answer questions from their fan base. And so, again, sometimes they're really silly, but sometimes they deal with, like, really important, like, moral and philosophical questions. Mm-hmm. And so it's like a good way to sort of get an intellectual break and just think of, like, are bell peppers airtight? I don't really know. Let's learn. Or to, you know, confront some more serious issues.
Cool. But it's also a way to learn that engages all of you. Mm-hmm. And so much of being in college is having your intellectual side engaged. Although when you're in a theater program, that's right. Different. But yeah. Cool. How do you feel? What's important about the attitude and the approach that you want to cultivate towards this next step? What are you trying to do to take care of yourself so that you are prepared for this next step?
I am just trying to remember that, you know, in terms of with transitions, it can be hard to make friends. Mm-hmm. And also that I'm going into a field where rejection is going to be a very regular part of my life.
Right.
And so I am just trying to remember that no matter what, like, I'm just going to do my best and I have something to offer, like, both as a friend, as a person, as an actor. And, you know, that's not always going to be right for what, you know, other people need as a friend or other people need from an actor, but it's right for somebody and it's worth something. And it's okay to be rejected and to struggle. Yeah. And I will figure it out.
Yeah. You are preparing to be resilient.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the exercise and the meditation and the lighthearted take on hard world realities kind of all help to support that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really neat. How is your mother migrated from India.
Mm-hmm.
You're traveling across the ocean to go to England. How does this, is this carrying out kind of a family, are you part of a family history here, or is this just your your little boat on the water?
I think it's mostly my little boat on the water. It's funny because, you know, I've talked to other members of the Indian community. They're like, you're going so far away. You're leaving your mom behind. And I'm like, you guys all left your family in India. Like, and some, you know, one person said to me, like, no, it's very different. Like, you want to go to the United States. Like, the United States is the place to go.
Right. And it's the happening place.
Yeah. And it's like, even my grandma said that. She's like, why do you want to leave? Like, and she, you know, she said in her adorable Indian accent, she's like, the U.S. When we were in India, it was all about the U.S. and you want to leave. And I'm like, it's just for 2 years. Like, I'm just trying to get new experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the rest of my family has all, like, stayed in the U.S., so... It's just going to be my little adventure.
And it's the accent is incredible. The U, yes.
The U, I mean, yes.
And it is kind of like an indictment, like the dart hits you, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And you came with a closing song, I Dare You.
Yes.
And what do you want to say about that before we play it?
Well, this is by my favorite band, Shinedown, and I love this song because it's basically... a challenge saying that you can put me through anything and I will survive. So,
okay. Well, yeah. With Julie, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thanks, Eric.
And I wish you well on this this chapter that is closing, that you're closing off, and the one that you're opening.
Thanks so much, Eric. It's been great being here.